Gavin Lentz, President of ICE. He says Iran's maximum resistance has foiled Washington's maximum pressure, as evidenced by the U.S. officials' acknowledgement of the campaign's failure. The U.S. planning to deploy a missile destroyer and fighter jets to the UAE a day after it fired Patriot interceptors to repel a Yemeni missile strike on the Persian Gulf state. And the UK says sanctions will come into force as soon as Moscow invades Ukraine, while the Russian president warns of U.S. attempts to drag his country into war. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this hour, Iran's president, Ebrahim Raisi, says Washington's policy of maximum pressure has failed to achieve its goals.
When the Americans openly acknowledge that they have failed in their maximum pressure policy, an ignominious failure, this is a victory for the Iranian nation.
Raisi said that Iran's policy of maximum resistance has offset the U.S. pressure. Raisi made the remarks during his visit to the mausoleum of the late founder of Islamic Republic Imam Khomeini on the occasion of the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Back in 2018, former President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 deal between Iran and world powers and intensified a campaign of sanctions to force Tehran to negotiate a new agreement. And Iran is marking the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. The event is marked every year with a 10-day celebration period known as the 10-day dawn. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has been present at this year's ceremonies and filed this report.
43 years ago this day, millions of Iranians flocked to Tehran's Mehrabad Airport to welcome the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, back to the country after 14 years of exile. The historic day was a milestone that put an end to centuries of monarchy in Iran. Ever since, Iranians have celebrated the occasion every year for 10 days. The event starts on the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's homecoming and culminates on the anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This period is called Dehe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn. As with every year, the ceremonies began with a visit by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to Imam Khomeini's mausoleum. The mausoleum also hosted state officials and people from all walks of life to mark the occasion.
Like every year, we gather today in this holy place to pay respect to Imam Khomeini, a man who changed the course of history in our country and established a political system that respects our beliefs as Muslims.
Today is an important day for us. We, the new generation, were not present those days, but we participate in this ceremony to learn about the personality of Imam Khomeini.
The Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini, who spent some 14 years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately led to the toppling of former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S.
During the Shah period, other countries like the U.S. made decisions for us. Iran was a U.S. colony. They were in our country to plunder our oil and other resources.
We lost many of our beloved ones for the sake of the Islamic Republic. By celebrating the event, we seek to say no to foreign interference in our country. We still stick to those ideals no matter how much pressure and sanctions the U.S. imposes on our nation.
Less than 2 months after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranians took part in a referendum where more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic as a new political system.
To Iranians, the 10-day dawn is reminiscent of their struggle for independence, a legacy that they're not willing to give up on, even if it means they have to endure U.S. sanctions. Now, one of the major goals of holding such massive celebrations is to pass on these messages to new generations. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The United States growing more engaged in the war on Yemen. The Pentagon is preparing to send fifth-generation fighter jets to the UAE in the wake of Yemeni strikes deep inside the Persian Gulf state. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says that Washington will also deploy guided missile destroyer USS Cole to Abu Dhabi. The U.S. will continue to provide early warning intelligence to the UAE. 2 days ago, Washington also intercepted a Yemeni projectile headed for the UAE. The Yemeni army has warned that it will continue to strike the Emirates as long as it keeps targeting Yemeni people. On Monday, Yemeni armed forces targeted a number of sensitive facilities in the capital, Abu Dhabi. The UAE is part of the Saudi coalition that's been waging a bloody war on Yemen for 7 years. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed directly from the war or indirectly from hunger and disease. We've reached out to political commentator Jason Enright to hear his perspective on the latest warning the Yemeni army has given. The UAE, here's what he had to tell us.
The UAE seems to be relatively good to go along with it, to give them whatever kind of support, at least political support to some degree, and I highly suspect material support in the background or whatever form that it might take, and that this, of course, would lead the Yemenis to bring the war to the UAE, as we have seen on at least one occasion, and then, you know, we're having them say that they're not afraid to strike out at basically anyone who's going to support the destruction of their country and the slaughter of their people. So maybe because I'm not really a war strategist kind of person, but it does seem like Saudi Arabia is looking for help. I mean, that, at least that's how it appears to my eyes. I mean, that wasn't how it was done at the beginning, but this change has been made. So I think that it is a change to some degree, but exactly what it is probably only in the heads of the Saudi planners themselves.
Our correspondent in Gaza, Asher Shannon, says the Israeli blockade is taking an ever more severe toll on the Palestinian healthcare system and inflaming the coronavirus crisis in the besieged enclave.
The situation in Gaza is extremely grim. Yesterday, the director of Shifa Hospital said that he expects that there is at least one case in every house in the Gaza Strip as the Israeli blockade continues to take its toll on the enclave. A few days ago, the Minister of Health announced that Israel has been preventing the entry of testing equipment and testing kits as well as surgical and hospital equipment into the Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has complicated all aspects of life in Gaza, especially in the health sector. At least 1,100 people have died directly because of the Israeli blockade. And also Gaza suffers from shortages in medicines and hospital supplies, and also the Israeli regime refuses or places tight restrictions on the exit permits to chronic patients who seek treatment in the occupied West Bank or in Al-Quds, Arash.
Lebanese capital Beirut holds a ceremony honoring tens of athletes and sports teams who've thrown their matches in solidarity with Palestine. Our correspondent Mayim Salah has more in this report.
In honor of tens of athletes and sporting clubs, the Global Campaign to Return to Palestine held the International Forum to honor anti-normalization athletes under the slogan Al-Quds Golden Medal in the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
We are honoring these champions from Iran and different Arab countries because they refused to play against an Israeli player because they don't recognize the so-called Israel. So they paid a heavy price for that. We look at them as heroes.
Fathi Nourin, an Algerian and world champion who pulled out of four different competitions after finding out he would compete with an Israeli competitor, was punished by the International Judo Federation, which withdrew his Olympics accreditation. But he tells Press TV that nothing is more significant than Palestine.
For us as athletes in Algeria, nothing is more valuable than the Palestinian cause, which is the cause of all Arabs and Muslims. And we are in solidarity with them and back them in any way we can. We have the chance to send a message to the world and raise awareness through sports about the Israeli terrorism, since the Israelis have been trying to win recognition through sports competitions, and we can through sports show the truth.
The athletes were honored through their matches in international and regional tournaments to protest the presence of Israeli players or teams. Two chess players also had their share of a gold medal. So did 14-year-old Mauritanian Mohammed Abdulrahman.
There was like three people that qualified from Africa and I qualified. And during that tournament, it was the last round, I played against this Israeli guy, and I just didn't play since it's a common gesture and I stand with Palestine.
The global campaign to return to Palestine stressed that they wanted to launch this initiative to show that these athletes who paid a price, whether being dismissed from international tournaments or deprived of important medals and valuable prizes, have won people's respect for their stance in defense of Palestine and the culture of resistance. These athletes said they decided to rescind an international competition and prize if it meant recognizing Israeli occupation and apartheid state. Yet little did they know that by so doing, they became champions for millions of hearts across the Arab and Muslim worlds. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The Turkish military pounding the positions of Kurdish militants in northern Iraq and Syria. The defense ministry says the airstrikes were carried out Tuesday against suspected bases of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, and the People's Protection Unit's YPG in Derik and Sinjar. The Iraqi Autonomous Kurdistan region says the attacks did leave casualties, but has not released the details. Turkey views PKK as a terrorist group and has carried out numerous attacks against the group. The PKK has bases and training camps in the Sinjar region of northern Iraq on the mountainous border with Turkey. Ankara has also a military presence in Syria, where it has seized swaths of land in military operations since 2016. And now to tensions over Ukraine and the contradictory assessment by Western officials over the possibility of a war erupting in the region. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian says there are no indications at this stage to suggest that Russia is preparing for a military action against Ukraine. But different signals are coming from the capitals of other Western states. Britain is threatening to impose sanctions on Russia if it invades its neighbor, with Prime Minister Boris Johnson saying it's vital for Russia to choose diplomacy. And the United States keeps alleging that Russia is preparing for an invasion, but President Putin has warned that the West is seeking to drag Russia into a war. Propaganda has even driven Ukraine's president to urge the Western states to tone down their rhetoric on the threat of war, saying such overstatements cause panic and harm to the country's economy. And the Omicron variant of the coronavirus keeps surging across the world, and the Czech Republic is the latest country to report record daily cases. More than 57,000 new infections in the past 24 hours, the country's highest single daily tally so far, but officials say hospitalizations remain steady and well below the previous waves. Denmark is another European country with a daily average of around 50,000 infections. It's also the first country in the EU lifting all of the COVID-related restrictions. The World Health Organization, however, says these restrictions should be removed slowly and with caution. The world body is warning that many countries have not even yet experienced the peak of the Omicron variant. Well, the conclusions of a much-anticipated inquiry into allegations of parties held at the UK Prime Minister's office during lockdowns last year is finally out. Although published in its unredacted form, the report has fueled anger among the public, political opposition, and members of Boris Johnson's own Conservative Party. Saeed Putazaz warned this report.
At 11:30 a.m. Monday, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson received an important email. In the attachment, a damning report into alleged parties under his roof last year. Among other things, a 13-page report by senior civil servant Sue Gray looked at 16 gatherings during the pandemic and found that the behavior was difficult to justify, with failures of leadership and judgment, and too little thought was given to what was happening across the country.
The complete version of the Sue Gray report is yet to be published, pending a police investigation. But the sheer scale of potential breaches meant that Boris Johnson had to face furious MPs in the building behind me in penitent mode again.
I want to apologize. I know that millions of people across this country have made extraordinary sacrifices over the last 18 months.
To the opposition, sorry was not enough.
The British public aren't fools. They never believed a word of it. They think the Prime Minister should do the decent thing and resign. Of course he won't, because he is a man without shame.
He has been investigated by the police. He misled the House. He must now resign.
Members of the Prime Minister's own party didn't pull any punches either.
Either my right honourable friend had not read the rules, or didn't understand what they meant, and others around him, or they didn't think the rules applied to number 10. Which was it?
And while the Prime Minister and the people around him were allegedly having a good time away from prying eyes, the rest of the people adhered to the rules. Those who didn't were stopped unceremoniously.
What it would take for this Prime Minister to go, I don't know. If this doesn't get in his way, then God help us all, frankly, in terms of politics in this country.
People are sceptical, and I think a lot of people also kind of think with the police, you know, quite rightly, obviously, number 10, there's a police presence. So people in the police were aware that, or should have been aware that, you know, something was going on in the back garden.
While people were dying and while people were unable to attend funerals, for him to be holding parties and agreeing to parties to be held when he made the rules is fairly immoral.
The public mood here is one of outrage at the moment, but experts say what Boris Johnson desperately needs now is not public support, but the backing of his own party members to avoid a leadership challenge. Saeed Purizep, London.
At least a dozen historically black colleges and universities in the United States received threats of mass shootings and bomb attacks. The threats in cities from Baltimore to New Orleans has forced authorities to enforce campus lockdowns. This coincides with the first day of the U.S. Black History Month. On Monday, a wave of similar threats forced the cancellation of classes at other schools. The White House says it takes these threats, quote, incredibly seriously, but that they still don't know what has motivated the threats. Last year, the U.S. intelligence services warned that racially motivated violent extremists such as white supremacists would seek to carry out mass casualty attacks in the country. And that's a wrap for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Remarks of the leader of the revolution about the 22nd of Bahman. After the passing away of Imam Khomeini and after his anniversary, this decade of Fajr must show that for the people, the memory of the Imam is as precious as the person of the Imam. Well, if it is decided that the memory of the Imam, like all ordinary memories, will gradually weaken, one day it will disappear. Know this. The day when we in this country do not have the memory of Imam Khomeini, the country will suffer a great loss. You should not let this happen. The memory of Imam, more than ever, is in the decade of Fajr and on the 22nd of Bahman. Even more than the anniversary of the passing away of Imam Khomeini, this commemoration shows his noble personality. This is in fact the birth of the Imamate of this country. In the same sense that the Imam and Islam themselves have drawn for us. Before that, Imam was the leader of the struggle and movement, but from the day he entered the country and formed the Islamic State, he became the Imam of the Islamic Ummah. This is more important than the memory of death.
Millions of Iranians across the country have begun 10 days of celebrations marking the anniversary of the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that put an end to the monarchy of the Pahlavi regime in Iran. You are listening to IRIB English Radio and Ayatollah Khamenei's speech on this regard.
The marches of our dear people on different occasions of the revolution, and most importantly on the 22nd of Bahman, are like a rain of mercy that acquaints eyes and hearts with the brilliant truth of the revolution, manifests the greatness of the revolution and the great Imam, and brings hope and happiness to friends, and it brings frustration to the enemies, and I thank God Almighty for this great success and grace, thankful, and the people of Iran for this effort, determination and loyalty. The 22nd of Bahman, an anniversary that is not a dry formal ceremony. Compare the anniversaries of the revolutions, the anniversaries of the national days in the countries, with this great movement of the people in our dear country. The anniversary of our revolution is not a dry and formal ceremony. It is a 100% popular ceremony. People take part in the severe cold and the scorching heat in all circumstances, where they need to be on the scene, and on the 22nd of Bahman, every year, the people of this field are honored and enter the field and show their presence to all enemies and opponents. This can be seen in the world. The 22nd of Bahman and the 22nd of Bahman March are a manifestation of national authority. It is a manifestation of the authority of the Iranian nation. It is a manifestation of the presence of the people and the national will and determination of the Iranian nation that men, women, old and young, take to the streets in all circumstances and present themselves in front of the eyes of the spectators throughout the country. This is very great.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In January 2017, a Canadian man fatally shot six worshippers at the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center and seriously injured 19 others. Over the past 5 years, Muslim community members have pushed decision-makers at all levels to denounce Islamophobia and put concrete measures in place to curb incitement and hate-filled violence, including through stricter gun control laws. Also, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who immediately called the killings a terrorist attack on Muslims, has since faced criticism and calls to do more to stem Islamophobia. Those demands grew louder in the aftermath of a string of hate-filled incidents, including an attack that left four members of a Muslim family dead in London, Ontario, last June. Also, in another hate crime incident, Canada's deadliest vehicle ramming attack happened in 2018, when a man plowed his van into a group of pedestrians in Toronto, killing 10 people. On Friday, the federal government announced in a statement that it intends to appoint a special representative to combat Islamophobia in Canada. But how effective would that be? Muslim Canadians are facing a sharp increase in violent hate crimes in public places and in places of work and worship. One example is the murder of Muhammad Aslim Zafis, who was killed outside a Toronto mosque in September 2020. Most recently, black Muslim women have also been disproportionately targeted by Islamophobic street harassment and assaults, particularly in Alberta. A report says in the last 5 years, more Muslims have been killed in targeted hate attacks in Canada than in any other G7 country. Also, over the past decade, police-reported hate crimes against Muslims in Canada have risen from 45 in 2012 to 181 in 2018. Now, on the 5th anniversary of the Quebec mosque shooting and the National Day of Action Against Islamophobia on January 29th, around a dozen Canadian Muslims are speaking out about experiences of Islamophobia in a new report from the charity Islamic Relief Canada. According to the report, many of those who've shared their experiences felt they were to be expected, living as a minority in Canada. The report also found that more women tended to be the targets of Islamophobia. A report by the National Council of Canadian Muslims stated that Muslims living in Canada have been increasingly facing anti-Muslim sentiments since the 9/11 attacks happened 2 decades ago in the US. The advocacy organization said Islamophobia is systemic in Canada and is evolving. The hate increased in the years immediately following the World Trade Center attack and has slowly grown since, with Statistics Canada reporting that anti-Muslim attacks numbered 99 in 2014, up from 36 in 2009. In 2015, hate crimes ballooned to 159, a 60% jump, and in 2017, incidents showed a dramatic increase to 349. Meanwhile, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Saturday said that Islamophobia is not acceptable at any cost and vowed to make his country safer for Muslims. But how successful has Trudeau been as a leader to address systemic Islamophobia as a major priority in Canada? Human rights advocates have criticized Trudeau's government for failing to meet its promise to deliver legislation to address hate crimes against minorities.
Now, the point is this, that this actually is not just as a result of 9/11. The level of Islamophobia around the world was actually very high even before 9/11.
Justin Trudeau had said while he is deeply opposed to Bill 21, which bars a range of public servants in roles of authority, including teachers, from wearing visible religious symbols, his government won't step into the legal challenge taking place in Quebec to avoid triggering a fight with the province over jurisdiction. In December 2021, an elementary school teacher in Quebec was told she could no longer teach in class because she wears a hijab, which is prohibited under Bill 21. That marks another failure for Trudeau as he falls short of condemning the bigotry against Muslims wearing symbols of their faith in his home province. Jeddah is the second largest city in Saudi Arabia and is home to 4.5 million people. Since late October, at least a million people in Jeddah have had their lives turned upside down amid a large-scale demolition push by the government. Residents say the demolitions have taken them by surprise and given them little to no room to plan their relocation because it was on short notice. The displacement has caused a housing crisis, with rental prices skyrocketing across the city. In some cases, rents have doubled in a matter of days and many aren't able to afford them. At least 10 neighborhoods have been completely wiped out so far, as work continues in around another 10 areas. The plan targets some 60 districts, mostly located in the city's southern part, and is expected to continue for months. Online footage and satellite images showed the wide-scale destruction of entire neighborhoods, which have been turned into dust. In 2020, similar demolitions carried out in the northern Tabuk province made international headlines. Saudi Arabia's Al-Huwaitat tribe sent an urgent communication to the United Nations, calling for an investigation into allegations of forced displacement and abuse by Saudi authorities. Their request came after months of alleged harassment, arrests, and abductions by the Saudi forces, apparently due to the tribe's refusal to relocate to facilitate the government's Neom megacity project. Also, Saudi security forces killed an Al-Huwaitat tribe member, Abdulrahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al-Huwaiti, who was an activist protesting his eviction. He had also denounced the Neom project on several occasions. At least 20,000 members of the tribe now face eviction due to the project, with no information about where they will live in the future.
And they've even destroyed most of the religious monuments of people like the prophet, peace upon him, and his household. So this just bulldozing history and bulldozing tradition is really in their blood. So I'm not that surprised that they're doing this kind of nuclear scale urban renewal, so-called project in Jeddah.
The Saudi Crown Prince's desert dream, Neom, is due to completion in 2025 on Tabuk's Red Sea coast. It's a city designed to attract international investors, but has been subject to scrutiny since it was announced in 2017, with critics calling it wasteful and inefficient in addressing the problems of the Saudi economy, including unemployment and dependence on oil. Currently, over 11% of Saudi citizens are unemployed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's oil sector still contributes up to 80% of the country's budget revenues, while 88% of Saudi Arabia's foreign income is from oil exports. Details of the Neom project prompted a flurry of reactions when it was first announced, as people accused Mohammed bin Salman of using extravagant technology to cover up the kingdom's human rights abuses. Ever since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has ramped up arrests of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others perceived as political opponents, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnations of the crackdown. The destruction of communities on the Neom side follows decades of tensions between the House of Saud and the tribes it has ruled over since the creation of the Saudi state in 1932. Exerting control over the land through construction projects or destruction of some heritage sites have marked this rule. In 2017, the UN condemned the kingdom's forced demolition of the walled city of Awamiya in the eastern Katif region as violating human rights.
The United States military has come under intense scrutiny over its procedures to guard against civilian casualties after a high-profile mistaken drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that claimed the lives of 10 civilians, including 7 children, on August 29. The U.S. military initially said it successfully targeted a Daesh terrorist who was linked to the attack on the Kabul airport that killed over 100 people, including 13 U.S. troops. The latest study by the RAND Corporation think tank concluded that systemic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were resulting in it falling short of its duties on civilian casualties. It added that in conflicts, the U.S. military's access to targeted areas is limited both before and after strikes, and it relies on intelligence gathered remotely using sources like drone surveillance and satellite imagery.
Well, the United States regularly violates its own and international laws about related to war, but I do think the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its use of drones entirely. We know because of brave whistleblowers like Daniel Hale and other journalists who have reported on drones and drone use that the U.S. often uses faulty intelligence to conduct these strikes, which do result in lots of civilian casualties.
The RAND study, which was required by congressional legislation, found that the problem is compounded by the US military when it fails to adequately talk to people from outside the US government or armed forces who might have access to information on the ground. After the RAND study was released, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a memorandum calling for the creation of a plan on civilian harm mitigation and response in the months to come, as well as the creation of Civilian Protection Center later this year. A senior Pentagon official later admitted that the department's data gathering strategies have been faulty and expressed the need to incorporate the figures from other sources in American tallies. The U.S. runs nearly 700 overseas military bases in at least 80 countries around the world. Such widespread military presence means that Washington has been involved in many wars, either covertly or overtly, to secure its interests. Those wars almost always result in many civilian casualties. The question is how the U.S. is planning to reduce the number of civilians who pay the cost of the war on their country with their lives.
Yeah, I think for many reasons the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its foreign policy. We need to move away from war first and foremost because of the impact it has internationally on countries like Yemen and Afghanistan and other countries the U.S. has been involved in a war inside of in the last few years. Also, the environmental impact of war. War and militarism is driving the climate crisis. And also, we need to do things in the United States, like cut the Pentagon budget to move us away from war and put more money towards things that actually matter, like free healthcare for all Americans and that sort of thing.
That being said, the simplest solution to the problem of civilian casualties overseas seems to be not conducting any such operations in the first place, as the U.S. military's track record in accepting accountability is far from acceptable, and at the same time, the countries where the U.S. has deployed troops in are calling for their withdrawal.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists use explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism, but in reality it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halted support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة الإمام موسى بن جعفر الكاظم عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And so it can be said that the blood running in the veins of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was the same blood as that of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Furthermore, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. From among the various beautiful qualities and characteristics of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that a few stand out. One of the qualities and characteristics of the persona of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, which really stands out, is his clemency and his restraint of anger. Kazim, of course, which is the title given to Imam Musa ibn Jafar. Kazim means one who restrains their anger. And so we find that the biographers and the historians clearly have written and announced and proclaimed that clemency was among the great qualities and unique characteristics
of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Historians have also unanimously agreed that Imam al-Kadhim repelled the greatest of offenses with kindness, and that he repelled the greatest of guilts from the people with pardon, just as his holy grandfather, the great Prophet Muhammad, may Allah bless him and his household, had done as well. And so, not only is the blood that runs in the veins of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam the same as the blood that was in the veins of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but the manners, the behaviors, the sunnah, the personality of Imam Musa al-Kadhim was just like the personality of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. These, dear friends, are the dialogues of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام لما سئل عن أدنى المعرفة: الإقرار بأنه لا إله غيره ولا شبه له ولا نظير، وأنه قديم مثبت موجود غير فقيد، وأنه ليس كمثله شيء.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, when he was asked about the lowest degree of inner knowledge, replied, "It is to affirm that there is no God but He, and that He has no likeness or match, and that He is eternal, positively proven to exist, present and not absent, and that there is nothing like Him."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, in the interesting conversations that we have and these dialogues from Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the seventh divinely appointed Imam, we find there's a very interesting conversation that happens between Imam al-Kadhim and one of the grandsons of the second caliph, Umar ibn al-Khattab. So one of the grandsons of Umar ibn Khattab, he ended up wronging Imam al-Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, and he cursed Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of Imam al-Kadhim's followers intended to kill this individual, Umar's grandson, but the Imam prevented him from doing so. Imam al-Kadhim decided to solve the problem in some other way. So he asked some people about where this individual lived, and they answered that he was a planter and a farmer on one of the outskirts of Medina. So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam disguised himself, mounted his ride, and went away. He found this person on his farm, and he went towards him, and he said to Umar ibn Khattab's grandson, whose name was Al-Umari, and he found that Al-Umari all of a sudden started to scream and say, "Do not walk upon my plants." The Imam, of course, was not walking on the plants, but he continued, and when he reached Al-Umari, he said with complete good words and kindness and gentleness and leniency, he said, "How much have you paid to sow your land?" Umar ibn Khattab's grandson said, 100 dinars. Imam al-Kadhim said, "How much do you hope to acquire from it?" The man replied, "I do not know the unknown." And then Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam replied, "I only asked you about what you hope it would bring to you." And then the man replied, "I hope that it will bring me 200 dinars. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam gave the man 300 dinars and said to him, "This 300 dinars is for you and your plants as they are."
Al-Umari all of a sudden changed and was ashamed of himself, especially when he found out that this was Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, the same Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam whose grandfather he had been swearing and cursing at. And one day after this event occurred, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam went to the mosque of the Holy Prophet Masjid al-Nabi, and he found that Al-Umari was sitting there praising Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. The beauties of being kind, lenient, using good words, and being gentle with the people. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
In another occasion, Abu Hanifa comes to Imam al-Sadiq and complains to Imam al-Sadiq about whom? About his son Imam al-Kadhim. He says to him that your son, when I walked past him when he was performing his salah, he did not extend his hand. Surely one should extend the hand and not allow an individual to pass in front of a person who is praying before Allah Tabaraka wa ta'ala. Imam al-Sadiq says to his young son, answer him ya Bunay, tell him, what is the answer that you have? Imam Musa al-Kadhim says, O my father, when I was performing my salah, I had dissolved myself and I was fully in attention and in awe of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala's presence that I did not even feel that anyone went past me. I did not even go through any experience that a human being has indeed gone in front of me during my salah. And therefore, from a young age, Imam alayhi salam's exalted characteristics and attributes was there for people to see. Yet when it comes to the biography of the Imam and his life, many people would perform the ziyarah of the shrine of the Imam in Al-Kadhimiyya in Iraq. Yet when it comes to understanding his teachings, when it comes to understanding his statements, when it comes to learning about his position and his stance against oppression, his patience, his perseverance, his forgiveness, many people will struggle to tell you about the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far. And that's why it's important for us to have a reflection upon the titles that the Imam alayhi salam was given.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello and welcome to a brand new series of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. I'm your host, Robert Carter. This week, we'll examine Israel's war against the Palestinian cause within the British education system and its attempts to impose an anti-BDS narrative into classrooms, specifically the use of a sophisticated behavioral change program targeting Muslim students. This sustained attack has entailed proxy groups editing textbooks, getting a lecturer fired, and more alarmingly, opened the doors for an anti-BDS group linked to Israeli intelligence to enter into UK classrooms. Solutions Not Sides, an initiative of the anti-boycott organisation One Voice, has spread widely across schools following the latest Palestinian uprising in May 2021. It was publicly recommended by former British Education and Defence Secretary and member of Conservative Friends of Israel, Gavin Williamson, in his letter to head teachers as a way of dealing with students' outpouring of solidarity with Palestine earlier this year. So let's delve in and investigate the truth behind the group's funding and their employees, which brings into question Solutions Not Sides' claims of neutrality, with Bianca Rahimi's eye-opening investigation coming up next.
Why is an Israeli intelligence-linked organization, which shared funders with the Friends of the Israeli Defense Force, illegal settler colonies in the West Bank, and the Conservative Party, teaching children about Palestine in British schools? The organization One Voice was founded in 2002 by Daniel Lebetsky, a billionaire businessman who sits on the advisory council of the Israel Policy Forum and is a current director of the Anti-Defamation League. Internal FBI documents indicated that the ADL was actually a proxy of the Israeli regime as far back as 1969. His organization, Peaceworks, aims to encourage trade between Palestinians, Egyptians, Jordanians, and Israelis in a bid to violate the international movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel until it complies with international law. One Voice is a continuation of that work, with Lubetsky claiming he was fighting BDS before people even knew that BDS existed, and asserting that One Voice and his funding vehicle, Peaceworks, are the best tools to undermine BDS. When studying One Voice's annual reports and the tax filings of its funders, we found that at least five of its financiers are invested in organizations that build illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. At least one of the funders financed the Conservative Party as well. For example, Ted Arison Family Foundation, which funds the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds illegal settlements in East Al-Quds, including Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan. The Karen Foundation, which also funds the ADL, Friends of the IOF, Jewish National Fund, and PEF Israel Endowment Funds. The Crown Family Foundation, which funds American Friends of the IOF and settlement organizations, the Jerusalem Foundation, and the Jewish National Fund. Catwin Puswillow Charitable Trust, which also funds the Board of Deputies, the Quilliam Foundation, the Conservative Party, the Jerusalem Foundation, and the Anglo-Israel Association. Trevor Chin, well-known lobbyist from the Israel lobby group BICOM and a person who funded Labour Party leader Keir Starmer's leadership campaign. The board of One Voice also consists of a who's who of suspected war criminals, such as Danny Rothschild, a former deputy director of the Israeli military intelligence, commander of IOF units in occupied South Lebanon and the occupied West Bank. Ephraim Sneh, former deputy Israeli minister of military affairs and brigadier general in the IOF and members of Commanders for Israel Security. As deputy minister, he was responsible for the assassination campaign against Palestinian figures, which was described by The Guardian as a policy of murder. Gideon Greinstein, founder of the Reut Institute, the Zionist security think tank and Israel lobby organization, which has described London as the hub of hubs of delegitimization for the Zionist project. Harriet Green, a director of BAE Systems, the British arms company which makes the HUD technology for target selections in Israel's F-16 fighter jets. BAE even has an Israeli subsidiary called Roka, which is a supplier for the IOF. Why is an organization which had three employees simultaneously working for the Israeli regime and at least 28 former IOF personnel and or Israeli intelligence among its workforce teaching about Palestine in British schools?
To discuss the issue of Israeli lobby activities in the British education system further, we have two guests in the studio with us today. Asa Winstanley is an investigative journalist who writes for the award-winning Palestinian news website, The Electronic Intifada. Asa has visited Palestine numerous times since 2004 and has written extensively on the workings of the Israel lobby here in the UK. And David Miller, an academic and former professor at Bristol University, who's also a leading British critic of Israel. David has co-authored a number of reports investigating the Israel lobby in both Britain and the EU. He's also a co-founder of the lobbying watchdog initiative Spinwatch. David was recently sacked by Bristol University after a sustained pressure campaign by pro-Israel groups. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on. I'm going to come straight to you, Asa. I'm relying on your expertise in this field for this analysis. From this investigation,